685-42, in re Beatrice B. Davis Family Heritage Trust. I'll give you a minute to get ready. Mr. Olson, would you like to reserve any time?
I would. 3 minutes, please. Okay. Good morning, Chief Justice Perry, fellow justices of the Supreme Court, counsel. It's good to be here in the state capitol this morning on Election Day. Thank goodness this one's over. May it please the court. My name is Michael Olson, and I represent the appellant and petitioner, Christopher Davis. My associate, Thomas Grover, is in attendance assisting today. The appellant is before this honorable court to ask it to review basically two orders. The first was entered in the district court on July 1st of 2015, and it took jurisdiction over the Beatrice Davis Family Heritage Trust, which I will refer to as the FHT, under a theory of constructive trust. And the second, although not titled as an amended order, is actually an amended order date entered in the court on December 31st, 2015, under which the court expanded its findings and altered the basis under which it was taking jurisdiction from a constructive trust theory to in rem jurisdiction under NRS 164.010. In my argument today, I will briefly address the issue of whether we are properly before the court on an appeal under NRS 155-190 subpart H, or a writ of petition or mandamus. Next, I will address the more weighty issues of jurisdiction and due process. So first, under NRS 155-190H, this case has been appealed because the language of that statute says an appeal may be taken to the appellate court, and I'm skipping, but of an order, subpart H, instructing or appointing a trustee.
Is the appeal limited to that issue, or can you go into other collateral issues under that statute? What's your position on that?
And that's an excellent question, Your Honor. I believe that the plain language of the statute does not in any way restrict or limit either the class of party that can bring the appeal or the scope of the appeal on an order. This court stated in D.R. Horton versus 8th Judicial District that statutory language must be given its plain meaning if it is clear and unambiguous. In this case, it says a party may bring, in subpart 2 of 155-190, it says a party may bring the appeal. It doesn't specify it has to be the trustee that was appointed. So I don't think that this appeal would be restricted to the appointment of the trustee, nor would it be restricted to only the trustee making the appeal. However, even if the appeal for some reason is improper, the appellant has also submitted a petition for writ of prohibition or mandamus. As this court stated in the Viega case, a writ of prohibition is available to arrest or remedy district court actions taken without or in excess of jurisdiction. In this instance, the district court has improperly taken jurisdiction over the FHT and over the appellant personally and is demanding that he appear in this jurisdiction for deposition and to produce documents, requiring specific action on behalf of Mr. Davis.
And where does Mr. Davis reside?
He has residences in Missouri and California, but not here in Nevada. Now, certainly the appellant is an aggrieved party under 3A subpart A because his due process rights have been violated. He never received personal service, and there has been no analysis of minimum contacts with the state of Nevada. Now, let's look at the jurisdictional issues, the personal jurisdictional issue. The U.S. Supreme Court in Schaffer v. Heitner found that only in personam jurisdiction allows a court to impose a personal obligation on an individual. In rem jurisdiction does not provide that authority. And as this court stated in the Fulbright case, When a non-resident defendant challenges personal jurisdiction, the plaintiff bears the burden of showing that jurisdiction exists. In so doing, the plaintiff must satisfy the requirements of Nevada's long-arm statute and show that the jurisdiction does not offend principles of due process. And this takes us back to law school, International Shoe, Worldwide Volkswagen, the analysis of traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. In this case, and as the court is aware, there's two types of personal jurisdiction, general jurisdiction and specific jurisdiction. General jurisdiction requires systematic and continuous contacts with the state. I don't believe that that even applies here. A respondent has asserted that it does, but there's been nothing presented by way of evidence that would show that Mr. Davis has continuous or systematic contacts. He doesn't have a residence here. And I believe the Fulbright case said it has to be as if this is his home state. It is not.
But if in this case here, and I follow you, it's one reason we're arguing a lot of complicated issues here, but my understanding is the trust protector moved the situs of the trust from Alaska to Nevada pursuant to the trust.
That's correct. Agreeing
to a declaration of trust. And Mr. Davis was the financial advisor for the trust. He did transactions and all. So what I'm wondering is if the trust was assuming it was properly moved to Nevada and Mr. Davis is doing actions pertaining to the trust and the situs of the trust is in Nevada, would that in any way give personal jurisdiction over him?
Your Honor, it would. And the problem here is that we have no evidence of what actions were actually taken by Mr. Davis. In fact, I'd like to read a quote from the hearing. This is the finding of Judge Sturman and her basis for finding personal jurisdiction. I'm quoting, this is the appendix, appellate's appendix, page 425, base number 425. Judge Sturman said, quote, I appreciate this argument that it's all invalid, and she was talking about the transfer, the First Amendment. And so Mr. Davis can't be sued, but my problem with that is he's been acting here, I assume, because stuff has been going on, apparently giving instruction to Dunham, and I just think that means he's consented to the jurisdiction of the court. That's the only finding that supports a finding of personal jurisdiction. You can't assume minimum contact.
Did the judge determine that the amendment was, he said it was invalid? Was that because she specifically looked to Alaska law to make that determination?
I don't think that she actually performed an analysis of Alaska law, Your Honor.
Do you think that's necessary in this case?
I think it is. I think it is, and I think it's required. You know, one of the problems is...
Wait, you read from the transcript, but the order of December 31st, item number 5, recites... The district court noted that it was appropriate to assume jurisdiction over the trust and its fiduciaries, Dunham and Davis, Christopher Davis, as all parties consented to the execution of the First Amendment and to the transfer of the trust situs from Alaska to Nevada, and all parties before the court acted upon a good faith reliance with respect to the validity of the First Amendment. Wasn't that part of the record? Isn't that her finding?
Well, I agree that's part of her finding, Your Honor, but you're touching on two different issues with all due respect. One is, does the court have in-rem jurisdiction over the trust, over the FHT? A completely separate analysis applies to whether the court has in personam jurisdiction over the investment trust advisors.
Okay, doesn't she get to that with respect to item number 15 in the findings?
Where she
says in personam jurisdiction over Davis as manager of FHT Holdings was also proper under Fulbright and Jaworski versus 8 Judicial and Viega.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor. FHT Holdings LLC is not a party. It's not a party. FHT Holdings LLC is a Nevada LLC, but it's not a party to this case. It's never been named as a party. And it's never been served with any service, not by mail, not
the ownership of that entity is owned by the trust, correct?
The membership of the holding company is owned by the trust. That is correct.
Yeah. And the manager of that company is also the investment advisor to the trust, as well as the sole manager of that LLC.
That is correct.
And isn't that the connection we should be talking about as to whether in personam jurisdiction exists over Davis?
So, Your Honor, we've briefed that issue, and I think it gets to the findings in Schaffner v. Heitner, U.S. Supreme Court case. And we also cited a Wyoming case that has been cited by the Nevada Federal District Court. And here's what the Wyoming court found in a case similar. The court found individual defendants have not created a substantial connection with Wyoming simply by accepting positions as directors and or officers of a Wyoming corporation and acting within those positions. There simply is not enough connection between individual defendants and Wyoming that they should reasonably anticipate being hailed into court. We don't dispute that Mr. Davis signed the First Amendment appointing himself as the investment trust advisor. We don't dispute that he's the sole manager of a non-party LLC. What we dispute is he has no contacts with the state of Nevada.
I assume you also acknowledge then that he signed the same document that transferred the trust to Nevada.
That's correct.
So why wouldn't one credit that act and that agreement as consenting to jurisdiction in Nevada?
Well, Your Honor, I would assert that having jurisdiction and exercising personal jurisdiction are two different things. He certainly subjected himself as an investment trust advisor. He realized that he may have to answer under in rem jurisdiction for questions about an operation of a trust, but he has not had any minimum contacts with the state of Nevada sufficient to make him personally responsible to show up here, attend a deposition, and produce his personal financial records, which is what they're asking for. They're asking for documents to go well beyond the scope of his actions as the investment trust.
Why should we entertain the writ now? Why shouldn't we find out what the documents are?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Why should we entertain the writ now? Why shouldn't we find out what the documents are?
Well, I think that you have to establish...
Maybe the documents demonstrate he's had some problems with his dealings with the trust.
Yeah, and Your Honor, again, this gets to another problem, in my opinion, where the district court erred. She said that Fulbright and Viega stand for the position that the court can take jurisdiction and conduct discovery. Those cases do not hold that. You have to have jurisdiction before you can conduct the discovery. And I also point out, the Dunham Trust Company is a Nevada trust company based in Reno, and that's the only entity that has taken any actual action, provable actions, and that company took $25,000 to pay an attorney fee. That's the only action that has been pointed to rather than speculation or assumed actions.
Okay. Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow members of the court, counsel, Madam Secretary. May it please the court, my name is Joshua Hood, and I represent Caroline Davis in this matter. And I'd like to address this court's inquiry in its December 9, 2015 order, specifically whether and to what extent the district court's order is appealable under NRS 155-1901H or any other statute or court rule, and whether a party can also challenge related interlocutory rulings in an appeal from such order. Now, as this court is aware, NRS 155-1901H permits an appeal from a district court's order instructing or appointing a trustee. Now, I'll be the first to admit it was difficult to discern in Christopher's pleading papers whether or not he was actually appealing the appointment of Dunham Trust Company, but to the extent that he was, I can see that that issue was proper on appeal, and it also should be denied, but I think that any other relief he's requesting beyond the appointment of Dunham Trust Company as the trustee under 155-1901H should not be applied to the appeal proceeding because there's no statute and there's no court rule, that authorize an interlocutory appeal for those issues. So I think that's more precisely addressed than the writ.
That's true. Well, say we agree with you, though, but with the writ, he can pretty much raise anything in the writ for the district court's action. So since these are consolidated proceedings with the writ, what's your view of the overall case and the other issues as well?
My review of the overall case is that I think we need to address the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room is the fact that Christopher expressly consented to the transfer of the trust situs from Alaska to Nevada, expressly consented that the Alaska trustee was then serving and could provide the advice, or excuse me, the consent to transfer the trust from Alaska to Nevada. Christopher expressly consented to serve as the investment trust advisor of this trust, which is a fiduciary under 163.554. Christopher expressly consented for Dunham Trust Company to be appointed as the trustee. And Christopher also expressly consented to serve as the sole manager of this Nevada limited liability company that is wholly owned by the trust. So I think it's improper for Christopher to come in, and it wasn't until the district court ordered him to disclose these documents, it's improper for him to come in and say, you know, I don't like the way these documents got me here, I don't like the way the statutes are written, you guys don't have jurisdiction, it's all improper. Christopher argues that the district court lacks the subject matter jurisdiction over this court, but again, he consented to the transfer of the trust situs from Alaska to Nevada. And then, Christopher also argues that the district court lacks in personam jurisdiction because of purported insufficiency of service of process and lack of minimum contacts.
Wasn't there a question, though, whether or not his consent was enough under Alaska law for that trust to be transferred?
Well,
has that been evaluated?
Do you mean the Alaska Trust Company?
Yes.
Right. I think if you look at the facts of this case, while it's true that the Alaska Trust Company did submit a letter of resignation, that resignation never took effect. And without even getting into Alaska law, if we look here at the facts, and NRS 472402 and NRS 472403, conclusive presumptions, the fact that Christopher and all parties consented to the fact that AUTC was the then serving trustee, and then AUTC and all parties relied upon that and acted upon it, Christopher is then precluded from coming back in and trying to falsify the truth of the matter asserted within that document, within the recitals. So I don't think it's necessarily an interpretation under Alaska law because all parties agreed that AUTC was filled.
So is the answer to my question that this was not done according to Alaska law, but we shouldn't think about it because Christopher, who's the party before the court, is arguing and he consented?
Well, no, I think it is applicable potentially under Alaska law, but simply submitting a resignation does not remove a trustee. The trustee needs to find a successor and then transfer of the assets. And I think all parties consented, again, that AUTC retained that power and that authority to transfer the trust from Alaska to Nevada. And all parties, again, acted upon the expressed consent by Christopher. So, again, it's not so much of a matter of disregarding Alaska law, but again, Alaska law, as well as the laws of this jurisdiction, do not remove a trustee simply upon submitting a letter of resignation. There are still steps that need to take place before a trustee is finally removed of its fiduciary obligations. Does that answer your question?
Not entirely. My question is whether or not this transfer from Alaska to Nevada was valid under Alaska law.
I believe it was, and it was valid under the trust document as well.
Okay.
Do you want me to get into the specifics?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Judge Sturman didn't make a specific conclusion of law on that issue, did she?
Well, I think the issue was
Alaska law is the proper to do the transfer.
I don't believe she did, but I don't believe she had to because it was proper under the terms of the trust. And I think the issue with respect to what took place in the district court was that there was this petition that was filed, and then all of a sudden a motion to dismiss was filed, then our opposition, and then a reply. The reply was filed 2 days prior to the hearing, and although it was filed in compliance with the Nevada electronic filing conversion rules, we never received a copy of it until 2 days after the hearing, and indeed the district court judge stated she never received a copy of it. And it was in this document that Christopher raised the arguments that the trustee, or excuse me, the beneficiaries didn't consent, there was no trustee serving, and there was no advice of counsel. Now, when we finally got a chance to address all of these, we showed that all the provisions of Article 14, Section 6 of the trust were complied with to transfer the trust situs from Alaska to Nevada. Unanimous consent of beneficiaries, trustee's consent, trust protector's consent, and the trustee has received advice of counsel. So I don't think we even need to get to Alaska law because the trust was complied with and all parties, again, consented and agreed upon the transfer of situs here to Alaska, to Nevada. Now, with respect to the service of process, Christopher is seeking, he said that.
Excuse me, counsel, if I interrupt you. You said when we finally got around to looking at the argument in the reply.
Mm-hmm.
Was this, what you just argued, vetted then in the context of the reconsideration motion?
It was vetted in that context as well as our motion to amend. So we were finally, we had a chance to present this to the district court, and she made the findings based upon the evidence that we submitted to her.
Okay, so in addition to that, counsel says that FHT has never been made a party in these proceedings. Could you address that?
FHT, the trust, or FHT Holdings, the LLC?
The company, the LLC.
The company. I think that that is appropriate, and that is true, that FHT Holdings was not made a party, but we do not need to name FHT Holdings as a party in order to get information and documentation from that entity, because it's wholly owned by the trust that Christopher is serving as the investment trust advisor of and is the sole manager of. And in fact, there is case law out there that, although there's not any here in Nevada, there is significant case law that stands for the proposition that where a fiduciary acquired full legal authority to manage the affairs of a corporation by virtue of his fiduciary relationship, that fiduciary is required to comply with his fiduciary obligations and the probate court is allowed to request information with respect to his control over the entity. So I don't think it's a matter of necessarily being forced to name the LLC, because Christopher is control of both and has the information in his capacity as investment trust advisor. Does that answer your question?
So your argument is that in his capacity as trust advisor, he's required to produce these documents where the LLC is owned entirely by the trust?
Correct. Christopher's attempting to argue he's got two different hats. He's got his hat as LLC manager, and he's got his hat as investment trust advisor. Christopher is the only person who, in his capacity as investment trust advisor, is the only person who has the authority to manage the investments of this trust. Christopher, in his capacity as the sole manager, is the only person with the authority to control the primary asset of the trust, or what was the primary asset of the trust, this $35 million life insurance policy, and it directly affects the beneficial interest of Caroline. So because he's wearing both of these hats and they're so inextricably intertwined, he can be forced by the probate court to disclose documentation related to the FHT Holdings LLC that directly bears on Caroline's beneficial interest in and to the trust, as well as that policy.
And is there a Nevada authority on that? I mean, we had that recent Mona case, which came up here with the trust, the issue that Rhonda Mona wasn't named as a defendant or as a trustee in that case, so limited what they could
done.
Now, how is this similar to Christopher here in this situation?
I don't think so. I think the fact that Christopher is the investment trust advisor, he's a fiduciary, he has an obligation of full disclosure to the beneficiaries of the trust with respect to all administrative faculties of the trust.
I think maybe we all would probably agree with that.
Okay.
Potentially, I don't know, but assuming we did, Mr. Olson's point is jurisdiction, that you have to serve him in Nevada, or he has to have the minimum context to assert specific jurisdiction in Nevada, and
right.
That doesn't exist, so you'd have the obligation to go chase him wherever he is to bring him and haul him into court or deposition to answer these questions. What's your position on that?
I don't think so. I think the fact that upon Christopher serving as, or accepting to serve as the investment trust advisor, NRS 163-5555 says he submits to the jurisdiction of the state of Nevada. And although Christopher argues there are not sufficient minimum contacts, I beg to differ. In fact, if you look at the record, Christopher has been serving as the investment trust advisor of this trust since February 24th, 2014. Christopher has been serving as the sole manager of this Nevada LLC, it's wholly owned by the trust since March 2014. Christopher, in his capacity as investment trust advisor, with the sole authority to direct and authorize Dunham trustee, who is the director trustee, caused or transferred or authorized the transfer of the trust's primary asset from the trust to the LLC. And I think, as this court is aware, we don't look at the quantity of the acts, we look at the quality of the acts.
Okay, so let's say we agree with you on that.
Okay.
Sufficient context here. How do you physically get him into court? Do you serve him with an order from the probate court? Do you subpoena him? What's the next step to do it?
Well, I think the fact that we served him pursuant to NRS 155.010 is sufficient. In fact, nothing in 153.031 or 153.031.2 requires anything above and beyond the method of service that Caroline used. And in fact, as Justice Hardesty and Justice Paragary noted in Webble v. 8th Judicial District Court, State of Nevada, County of Clark, when a statute is clear on its face, we will not look beyond the plain meaning of the statute. NRS 155.010 is plain on its face. There's nothing in it that requires acts for Caroline that go above and beyond what she did in order to give him notice. And there's no argument here that notice was reasonably calculated to provide him with the pendency of the action and an opportunity to appear and defend. And in fact, he admitted that he received the petition and the notice. So I believe that that notice, and this court and the United States Supreme Court, have routinely recognized the sufficiency of mailed notice to provide a party with the pendency of the action and give them a chance to come back in and defend themselves. And I believe that that notice right there in and of itself is sufficient to hail Christopher into this court. And based upon his acts with the forum state, he can reasonably be expected to be hailed into this court in order to answer what he's done as the administrator, or excuse me, investment trust advisor, and as the LLC of this Nevada LLC that's wholly owned.
Okay, and let's say he ignores it and doesn't come into court. What's the remedy?
Well, I think because he's submitted to the jurisdiction of Nevada and that it has in personam jurisdiction over him, he can be ordered by the court, and if he's not, then I think contempt proceedings would be appropriate, or sanctions. So, again, I think personal jurisdiction here, whether it be general or specific, has been satisfied because he has directed contacts here, because he has purposely availed himself of the laws of the state of Nevada and the protections of the laws, and this court, the district court, is able to assert in personam jurisdiction over him.
What has he done that you contend subjects him to in personam jurisdiction here as an individual?
Well, I think he
consented to the transfer of the trust from Alaska to Nevada. Other than that, what has he done that you claim constitutes consent to in personam jurisdiction?
Okay. Well, first and foremost, we're trying to assume jurisdiction over him in his capacity as investment trust advisor. We're not seeking any personal documentation, although he contends to the contrary.
There's a handwritten interlineation, though, on the disclosure order that he's also being subjected to personal jurisdiction for disclosure purposes as manager of FHT Holdings.
On the which order, I'm sorry?
The
initial order?
Yeah, the June 24th order.
Right, I think that has to do with information related to the trust. If you look at the order and the information that he's required to disclose, it's information related to the trust, the loan, the policy, any collateral that's there, you know, the whole nine yards with respect to those policy loans and FHT. It's not requesting any of his personal documentation. But to answer your question with respect to what contacts he's had with Nevada, again, the transfer of that policy, the $35 million policy, which was intended to benefit the descendants, decedent's descendants for generations to come, was transferred from the trust, of which Caroline has a beneficial interest in, to this LLC, of which she only has a tangential beneficial interest by virtue of the trust ownership, if you can even argue that. She has no control or interest in this LLC, and that right there, in and of itself, is big enough and is enough. The national quality of that act is sufficient to assume jurisdiction over Christopher. Moreover, now that the LLC owns that policy, Christopher, as the manager, has the ability to terminate the policy, change the beneficiaries of the policy, and to take additional loans from the policy without the consent of anyone else who has a beneficial interest in that policy. Christopher's actually already tried to do that. We presented evidence to the district court that he did try to take additional policy loans in the amount of $489,500 to himself individually, to himself as a trustee of a Missouri trust, and to himself as a manager of an LLC of a Missouri LLC. So Christopher has tried to take action and has taken action here in Nevada. Moreover, Christopher, as a fiduciary of a Nevada trust, has refused to abide by his fiduciary obligations to beneficiaries of a Nevada trust by failing to disclose documents that this beneficiary of Nevada trust is entitled to. Have any more questions?
All right, colleagues.
Justice Cherry, do you have any other questions?
No, Chief.
I'd like to ask one.
Justice Hardesty has a question. Go ahead.
You're relying on, could you clarify the statute on which you're relying for service on Davis, Christopher Davis?
Sure.
If you look in connection with the 163.555.
So you want me to address 163.5555?
No, the statute under which service was affected.
I
may have misunderstood what you said. I thought you said 155.010.
Correct. I think if you look at NRS 153.031, that statute provides a beneficiary with a way to get to the court to request relief.
Right.
153.0312 provides, except as otherwise provided in this chapter, a petitioner seeking relief under 153.0311 serves it under 155.010.
Right.
Now, NRS 155.010 says, except as otherwise provided in this section, or specific statute relating to this kind of notice, or otherwise ordered by the court, the petition and notice are to be mailed to a person who's interested. And again, the issue around notice and service is that it's got to be reasonably calculated under the circumstances to provide the interested party pendency of the action and an opportunity to appear and defend. Christopher admitted he received that notice, and there's nothing in NRS 155.010 that goes above and beyond the requirements that Caroline satisfied. And in fact, Christopher's attempt to try and receive personal notice is nothing more than an impermissible collateral attack on a clear statute that has no defect.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Justices.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, I have a question after hearing his latest response. We'll have to caucus on these statutes, and I know you disagree with what counsel just said, but ultimately, isn't Christopher going to have to produce these documents no matter what? I mean, at a minimum, they could get a commission to take a deposition of him with a subpoena ducis tecum outside of Nevada, and he's going to have to cough them up at that stage. So what are we arguing over here?
And that's an excellent question, Your Honor. They can do that, obviously. They could properly serve him with a subpoena. They could take an out-of-state deposition. That's a lot different than violating his due process rights by requiring him to come into the state of Nevada, appear as a party, and be subject to in personam jurisdiction. As you know, a lot of
isn't a fiduciary in a trust subjected to the jurisdiction of this state? If it is acknowledged, and maybe there's a dispute about whether the trust is properly in Nevada or not, but if there is a conclusion that the trust is properly situs in Nevada, and he's a fiduciary in that trust, as a fiduciary, doesn't this state have jurisdiction over him under 163.555? And don't the service rules in 155.010 permit the service of the order that satisfies appropriate service?
Two separate questions there, and I'll address both. The first is really the crux of what this court is being asked to do in this case, and that is you have to look at NRS 163.5555 and decide whether you're going to interpret that as a waiver of your due process rights and you're just automatically subject to jurisdiction, or if you're going to view it in conjunction with Fulbright and in conjunction with the Nevada long-arm statute and say, no, 163.5555 potentially renders you subject to jurisdiction, but you still have to find minimum contacts. Remember, the second section of 163.5555 says that an investment trust advisor or a distribution trust advisor can be found to have jurisdiction based upon their actions. And again, what actions are we talking about? What is it Christopher Davis has specifically done in the state of Nevada that has had an impact on the state
of Nevada? Isn't the transfer of whatever remains of a $35 million life insurance policy to an LLC an investment decision on a trust in this state?
That was actually accomplished by the trust protector, Your Honor, and it was accomplished by a trustee. Justice Pickering asked a great question about Alaska law, because what you have, the problem you have in the transfer of situs is you have Alaska USA Trust Company resigning in December, and almost 3 months later, the situs is transferred. And they say, well, Alaska USA Trust Company signed a release, so they were still acting as trustee. That's not true. There's an Alaska statute, and it's cited in the briefs, Alaska statute 13.36.0771. It gives interim powers, for lack of a better term, to a trustee who has resigned or been terminated. And those powers are limited to protecting trust property. Well, that does not include a transfer of trust situs. So Alaska Trust Company didn't have authority to transfer this case down to Nevada.
Apart from the statute, what does the trust say about a trustee who attempts to resign?
What does the trust say about what?
A trustee who attempts to resign. The trust itself.
It says that within 30 days' notice, a trustee can resign. And they tendered notice in October of 2013, and they said, our resignation is effective December 5, 2013, or when a trustee is appointed, the earlier of which is to occur.
But you do concede that all the beneficiaries consented to the transfer of the situs from Alaska to Nevada?
Actually, not all of them signed off on it, Your Honor. Our position is that one of them was missing, and that is the wife of our client, who under Article 8, Subsection 3, was entitled to receive distribution.
Well, but under the terms of the trust, and it was specifically indicated in the order, there was a provision that didn't make her a spouse under the terms of the trust because the amendment and the transfer was signed after the fact. So
that's right, and that's a trust interpretation issue, Your Honor. There are three different definitions of spouse within the trust. It's a long trust.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Justice Cherry, anything?
No, Chief.
Okay. Counsel, thank you both very much for your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. We'll stand in recess until 11:30. Thank you.